What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TJTV podcast, only on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Anchor.fm. So I'm not going to talk much in this intro and outro. I'm literally just outside right now, and I've been wanting to put this episode out pretty much since yesterday. It was supposed to be out, and I never got a chance to do it. So unfortunately, I just got to do it like this. I also wanted to do like another episode, and I had an interview scheduled tonight, but we had to reschedule. So yeah, I mean, oh well, it is what it is. So here's the deal. Next week, I will do 3 episodes of the TJTV podcast. I will have an interview. I will have an episode where it's just me talking about what's been going on the last week. And I will have another interview. So I'm planning to have at least like 2 interviews next week. But I will do 3 episodes next week. Just because I feel like I'm letting you guys down. I mean, the next 2 days at work, I'm going to be busy, so I really won't have time to do a podcast. I'm going to be working at least 13 hours, both Thursday and Friday, which I'm not too upset about, but, you know, it is what it is. So, yeah, can't wait for that. Anyways, so today on my show, I had Womp Stomp Films, and this was a really great podcast. I mean, so Womp Stomp Films, he has a series called Never Hike Alone, and it's about Jason Voorhees. And he just told me pretty much how his whole company came together and how he started. It was a really fun interview. It's about 1 hour and 5 minutes long. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. So that's it. No more talking. I'm done for today. Love you guys to death. I will see you guys next week. And you'll hear it in the outro. All right. Let's get on with the interview. I'll just segue right into the interview. Here we go.
All right, I'm here with Vincent DeSanti, who is part of Womp Stomp Films on YouTube, and he actually does some pretty good cinematography. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me, TJ.
Thank you for coming on. So what gave you the inspiration to start the channel?
I mean, Womp Stomp Films kind of came into existence out of necessity. We were starting to put together the Never Hike Alone project. And, you know, we had, you know, up at that time, I had a financial advisor for what I was doing in my life anyway. So when I told him I was doing this, he was like, you know, it's best if you're going to do a movie, don't, you know, put everything in your name, because if something goes wrong with the movie, or if say you do this fan film and you end up getting sued, if you get sued, they can take all of your assets. If you build an LLC, well, they'll sue the LLC, but your personal assets will be protected. And so I went, okay, what are we going to call this thing? And I just happen to have an internet handle that I've been using for a long time called Womp Stomp. And I was like, Womp Stomp Films, that makes sense. It's just a name that stuck with me for a long time. It actually came out of a Star Wars video game for Nintendo 64, where if you put in the password Wampa Stompa, you could turn into the ice creature, the Wampa, and go around the level and start like smashing stormtroopers. And I always just loved that sort of like, the password always just made me laugh. So it went from Wampa Stompa Online to Womp Stomp, and then Womp Stomp Films. But what's interesting is that, you know, we got the inspiration to do Never Hike Alone. I was on I was just on sort of like a generic location scout with someone, and we were out in the mountains, and We came across this set of cabins, and I said, wow, this makes me feel like I'm at Camp Crystal Lake. I wonder what would happen if I was out here taking photos and Jason came after me. And so sort of the idea with that, my love for Friday the 13th and just being a big Friday the 13th fan since I was a little kid and seeing other fan films that had been out there and done in the past, but didn't have the equipment that was available at the time in 2017. And I think it was just kind of like a perfect storm of all these things coming together. And Womp Stomp formed around that. It, you know, started as, you know, just that LLC. It was me and a few other people. And over the year, that team has grown from, you know, five or six people to over 100 people that we've employed to make, you know, the Never Hike Alone films and some of the original stuff that we've done.
Wow. Yeah, no, so yeah. My wife saw the film. We're big Friday the 13th fans as well. And I was born on that date, actually, in January. But how much did that all cost just to get that whole production started? And when it came to filming, what was that like?
I mean, it was a pretty good investment. I mean, it was, you know, it was a couple $100 at a time. It was a couple $1,000 at a time at the start, because at the time I was working in feature animation. I had been working in the industry for about 8 years, and I had, you know, worked my way up the chain and was making decent money, and, you know, I had some money to spend. So I, you know, built a costume, and that took, at the end of the day, a couple $1,000s. You know what I mean? I had to get the, you know, I got a CFX hood. I got the CFX hands. I had CFX make me a custom hockey mask. I bought all the clothes online, and, you know, it wasn't just the clothes that I bought that ended up in the film. It was the clothes that I bought that didn't end up in the film, having to test it out and try it out and look at it on screen. And there was a lot of time just spending, you know, going out with, you know, someone just to take a photo, or go out with a camera and test a camera and test the costume. And there was a lot of that leading up to the beginning of Never Hike Alone, because we had done sort of a run and gun version of it, I want to say in like 2014, 2015, with a costume that cost maybe a couple $100s, like if that. You know, I bought like a latex hood for maybe $75 on eBay. I had a NECA, you know, part three recreation mask, you know, a Dickies shirt, Dickies pants, and some boots, and that maybe ran me $150, $200. But when we filmed it and we tried to do it with like the bad equipment, it looked bad. And I, as a filmmaker, was like, this isn't what I'm going for as a filmmaker. Like, before I start releasing stuff to the world or like putting stuff out in public, like, I want to learn how to do a couple of, like, I want to learn how to play better songs, really. You know what I mean? Like, if I was a band and I listened back to my demo, I'd be like, okay, well, I got to get better. And I, that's the years I spent doing it. And as I worked my way up and was investing in, it took time. It wasn't just the money. It was the time. It was raising, it was enough time to raise a little bit of side cash, spend it on some stuff, go out with my friends and shoot it, come back and look at it, and kind of go through that rigmarole while I'm also going and working on other sets and starting to learn more about live action production. And, you know, the things I have to do to build sort of a live action team to match what I wanted to get. So it probably took another year and a half, 2 years of just research and doing that, probably a couple $1,000s just to get started. And that first, you know, trailer that we shot in May of 2016, I want to say the most we spent to get all of that there was maybe $2,000, $2,500. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, when you count all the costume stuff there, driving up and down, renting all the cameras and trying some stuff, and we actually landed on what we wanted, I would say that's how much it was. We weren't able to raise the amount of money that we wanted to with our initial crowdfunding campaign. We were going for $40,000, but we only raised about $28,000. So we never saw any of that money, because it went right back, because Kickstarter doesn't allow partial succession. You need to complete your entire goal. You need to meet your goal on Kickstarter, and then they give you your money. So no one was ever charged, but there were people who were inspired by our campaign who, with the amount of money that like I had saved up and put in as an investment, and then other people had sort of said, hey, listen, we don't need Kickstarter to support you. We just want to come in on this and help you. We raised about $20,000. We used that to go out in the fall of 2016 and shoot, I would say, three quarters of the movie. A lot of the movie was shot. We had a lot of the movie in editorial, but it wasn't completed. That winter, we cut a better trailer. We released a new trailer in January of 2017. We ran a new campaign in January, February of 2017, which we found out wasn't the best time to run a campaign after Christmas. But hey, we ended up raising, you know, we put the goal at $13,000. We ended up raising just shy of $20,000. We received probably about $15,000. And with that money and a little bit of extra from some of our previous personal backers, you know, about 20 grand is where we came to with actual money. We were able to go out and finish the movie, go through editorial, and then we had the film out in, you know, October of 2017. But to get to October 2017 was really a process that started as early back as 2013, 2014, just like the kernels of the idea of like what I wanted. And then by the time I got to 2017, I had gone through all of the steps and raised the money and gone through the trials and tribulations of learning how to crowdfund, learning how to become a cinematographer, from the sense standpoint of a director cinematographer. You know, I had Chris Ellis on the first movie. He was really great cinematographer who really helped out. JD March was the other cinematographer, director of photography. And now Evan Butka is our main, you know, our core director of photography for Never Hike in the Snow and Never Hike Alone too. They're my camera people, but as far as what I needed to know as a director to give them proper direction, that was that's the process that took from about 2013, 2014, getting to 2017 to reach that level of it.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of work.
That sounds like a lot of work. I mean, like when people make movies, like I never realized how long it actually takes just the whole process from beginning to end. And like, it seems like you had like a long wait list of time just to research and then get the people and then the money right. And it just sounds crazy altogether.
Yeah. But and you know, it wasn't like in 2013, I got together and said, hey, I'm going to make a 60-minute like fan film out in the middle of the forest and we're going to do all these things. It wasn't like I had that idea right away. My original idea was, you know, it'd be really cool if I made a cool looking costume, I put it on video, it's 5 minutes long and it just looks really rad and I can post it on a Friday the 13th forum and people are going to think it's cool. That's all I wanted. You know what I mean? That's where it started, but it was sort of this like, you sort of open one door and you see other opportunities. So, you know, in the pursuit of all of these things, you know, we started as a 5-minute short. It was going to be that way. And then along the way, we ended up discovering that abandoned camp. And when we discovered the abandoned camp out in the middle of the San Bernardino National Forest, we sort of had to step back and look at what we were going to do and what we were going to accomplish. And it was very incremental sort of goal setting. So it was like, hey, if you can run a mile, maybe you can run 2 miles. If you can run 2 miles, maybe you can run 4 miles. And there was a lot of that type of like, as we were going through, it was like we were going through training and boot camp. And the more we did it, the more ready we felt to take on more. And then we would overburden ourselves and have to really bail ourselves out and work our way back. But we'd learn from that, get better the next time, and sort of just keep repeating that process. But the end goal was always to create something cool that fans were going to celebrate, like give fans a reason to be happy about Friday the 13th and not another bad news about a film getting canceled or like, you know, the lawsuits weren't really going around at that time, but a lot of it was about like, they couldn't get a film off the ground and it kept getting delayed. And there was no development positives for the Friday the 13th. And as a fan, I just wanted to fill that void. I wanted to fill the void of Friday the 13th in my life. And I said, if the studios weren't going to do it, I guess I'll do it for myself. And I'll just have fun with my friends doing it. And whoever else enjoys it will be pretty cool. The outcome was never what I intended. It was definitely a welcome outcome because you do want people to want to watch your films. You know, as a filmmaker, like we don't do this so we're the only ones who can watch it. We do it so we can put it out in the world and people want to sit down and spend time watching your art. That's the like, forget money, forget all of those things. Cause I've worked in the industry. I've made money. I've worked on projects that have taken 3 years, you know, have cost millions of dollars, have gotten $1 million ad campaigns and have been out in the world and haven't done very well. And even though I got paid very well to do the film and I had a lot of fun making it, there's that extra level of like, you want people to look at everything that you've done over that time, that those 3 years that you dedicated to your life, you want them to enjoy themselves. So when people, you spend that much time on something and somebody doesn't enjoy it, it sort of goes, well, why did I spend that much time working on it? And obviously you go back and look at it. Well, I made all these contacts. It helped me later on in my career. I learned a lot of other things, but I still wanted to go after that. Like, I really want to make something that people want to watch, that it's something that like me, like growing up, no matter what my mood was, I wanted to get up. I'd throw on a Friday the 13th. I could watch any of them anytime. And so it's a cool feeling that Never Hike Alone sort of ascended to that and that Womp Stomp Films grew to that, but it really wasn't like it was day and night. It was definitely a long journey of discovering different things and learning things along the way that we made the, basically everything that happened after October 2017 was the result of honestly, starting back in 2008 with me starting in the film industry and learning about filmmaking, going through my first film and, you know, being on a film for 3 years and seeing how a film goes from a pitch, you know, just like a, you know, 2-sentence pitch all the way to a, you know, a 75-minute, 90-minute animated film that took 3 years and $70 million to make. You sort of like, you learn the process. And so then trying to replicate that process with no money, that became another challenge. And so that's sort of been the, and it's all been sort of self-motivated too. It wasn't like I had deadlines. It wasn't like anyone telling me that I had to do this. It was just out of curiosity. It was just out of my own, like my own passion to want to do this and get better at it. And that's what fuels it. It's just my own curiosity. It's my own, you know, love of the art. It's my own want to give an audience something that's worth watching and to get put all my effort into it and to, you know, work with my team to come up with ideas and do things that they really, that we can do to really show off everyone's skill set. And then in turn, give our audiences something to really sort of sit back and enjoy.
Wow. That's cool though. I like that. I like the way that you use the same rules that the producers did in every Friday the 13th film, where basically Jason was around, but like no one really like knew he was there. Like when he had like the ch-ch-ch, like I love how you use that in your film mm-hmm. that you made. But how long did the film take in general? Like how long was that all?
It started in, you know, real shooting for it began in probably August of 2016. And we didn't stop shooting till August of 2017. This okay. was going up on weekends. You know, I was working a full-time job at the time. So we were going up on weekends or we'd be taking like long weekends, you know, take a Friday and a Monday off, take a Thursday through a Sunday, kind of do stuff like that to get bigger scenes up. And it was, I mean, the amount of shoot days on Never Hike Alone 1 were ridiculous because we reshot a lot of things just because we were testing cameras. And then we got into a point in editorial where we noticed that like we had upgraded so many different areas of the film that the places where we never upgraded or a couple places that we didn't upgrade were showing. And we had to go back and reshoot those. And so it probably took about, I want to say, it must have been 30 to 40 shoot days, like if not more, honestly, because we did so much. And then we turn around and make Never Hike in the Snow and we shot it in 6 days. You know, Never Hike Alone 2 was shot in 16 major days. You know, that was a big production and more typical of like a 2.5 week sort of structure. And is more like on point with how what I've experienced, what live action sort of schedules are like versus what, how we did the first one, which was piecemealing it because that's all we could do. That's all we could afford. And it ended up costing more in the long run, but in the short term spurts, we could sort of raise enough to do just this part. And if we get that part, that's just another piece of the puzzle. And then we move on to the next piece of the puzzle. And so it always became about what can we accomplish now? What can we do now? Or what is it going to take to get to the next step? Let's focus on those steps. Let's get that part of the thing done and then focus on the next part. And it's sort of like that mentality has really helped us as an indie brand not look at the top of the mountain and get discouraged because, you know, on day one, I might not have enough money to get to the top of the mountain. You know what I mean? But I know going up the mountain, I'm going to continue to raise money. I know I'm going to continue to have opportunities to like get more investors. And the more that we invest in the project, the more I have to show people and the more I show people things and the more new things we have to show, the more investors we get. So you sort of have to like understand that that's the process. And the first time you go through that process, it's really daunting because you can't predict whether or not the money's going to be there. And it's not that you can predict the money, but at this stage, since I've done it so many times, I can say like with confidence that like, okay, looking at my trends, I should be able to cover this by then. I should be able to do this. And if not, I need to put more effort into some crowdfunding things. I need to do more social media work. Or I need to, okay, you know what? Social media is doing fine. We got a good wave. I'm not going to touch it. I'm going to let it go. I'm going to focus on the movie and focus on the task that I need to do as a filmmaker. And so there's a lot of balancing of tests too. And if I didn't have like, you know, a good producing team and I didn't have my friends helping me, there's no way that I could do it. It's not that I do it all on my own, but I definitely, as the, you know, kind of the sole leader of, of Womp Stomp Films as an entity, as Womp Stomp Films, I have to take responsibility and sort of kind of wear a lot of hats in order to fill in the gaps that we have, because we may be a company with an amount of people, but we still don't have enough people to cover every single thing that needs to get done. So a lot of people are wearing different hats and doing different jobs that if we were at a normal studio, you'd have, you know, one person for each one job. And we're kind of like three people doing 25, 30 people's jobs.
Yeah, no, I see where you're coming from. It's kind of like I work on the radio, and like I thought like maybe like one or two guys like working on like the microphones and all that, but it turns out there's a lot more that goes in the radio. You got the engineering side, the producing side, the this side, that side, you know. So I know exactly how it is when it comes to filmmaking and whatnot.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely at that level.
What film did you work on when you, I mean, are you still in the film industry or like besides Womp Stomp, or are you just doing Womp Stomp full time?
No, I still work in the film industry. And I have been working in the film industry since 2008. I haven't stopped. I just switched sort of my positions around. I started in feature animation. I started on a film called Free Birds. Which is about two turkeys that discover a time machine, go back to the first Thanksgiving, put turkey on the menu. Yeah. It was a great experience. The film came out in like 2011, 2012, or even 2013. I was on it for like almost three years. And that was an amazing experience because that's what taught me about development. That's what taught me about writing. It was a really good sort of like right into the fire with, you know, my first project of seeing how everything came together. I then moved on to another project called Rock Dog, which came out, I believe, in 2015 or 2016, and was another animated production, took another 2 years to make, was a lot of fun, got a writing credit on that one. And then I went to another animation company and worked on my own project and ended up getting canceled. But I was also working on another project at the same time called Duck Duck Goose. So I was sort of like wearing both hats. And came on and sort of helped them out. And it was when I was working on Duck Duck Goose in 2015, 2016, or mostly 2015, 2016. That's when the Never Hike Alone project really started to take off. And in the winter of 2016, January of 2017, I actually left animation in order to pursue Never Hike Alone full time. I took the year off. I finished the movie. I got it out in October. And when the film was over, I was sort of in the mood to change careers. I went and started working on live action productions, working for the assistant director's department. So I was like a second AD on some Lifetime movies, on a Hallmark movie. And then I got into some more bigger league studio style TV shows where I got to work in the AD department, but I had to go all the way down to PA. So I took this big step back in my career in order to sort of relearn how the sausage was made from a live action perspective, because I had been in animation so long. And the type of live action production that I was taught in school was sort of outdated. And it wasn't at the level that was happening at the studio level. Like we were doing like very indie docu style, sort of very specific style of filmmaking, very much like documentary style filmmaking. So my school didn't really give me the tools I needed to be a narrative filmmaker, you know, as far as like knowing the tools that needed to be on the ground in order to make that happen. I could run a TV studio. I could do interviews. I could do all the TV news stuff because I wanted to be a journalist at the time. But to be a filmmaker and to tell a narrative story with film was something that I needed to learn from a technical standpoint, because I learned how to tell story and how to sort of do shot selection and do all those things in animation, because it's a lot of it's exactly the same language. But going into live action, now you're in the real world. You need to really make it happen with a camera. You need to know what camera you're working with, what lens you're working with. You know, there's lots of different things that you just need to know that, like, I just didn't have that knowledge. So going through Never Hike Alone taught me a lot about that. It was a very hands-on experience, but it was like, how do I run a better production? How does the set run? How do we set things up? What do things look like at a professional level, not just the indie level where my friends are doing it? It's my friend's call sheet. It's my friend's, you know, production email. It's a lot of stuff like that. It was like, what happens when I get an email from a studio? What does it look like? What does the call sheet look like? Well, how does the day run? How does the communication work? You know, what's the chain of command? What's, what does, how does communication work? Like, how do people talk to each other when you need to achieve something? What's, you know, all these different questions that I had about, like, how do the professionals do it? I got to go on set as someone who had, you know, a very in-depth knowledge about how productions come together. I basically worked my way up to line producing and animation. So I knew how to break down a budget. I knew how to schedule. I know how to do all of those things. I just needed to know how to apply it to a live action setting. And once I saw how it was applied to a live action setting, a lot of things made sense to me very quickly. It was a very much like, okay, this equals this, this equals this. Now I understand. So now when I'm on set, I can look at a lot of things and know what it costs to be there. I can understand that how expensive they were on, how many people are here, you know, from which departments, how much representation is there. Their minimum is this, their minimum is that. If they're making more, they're probably making that. Okay, we have a techno crane on set today. Okay, that's this type of rental and that's that much money. And so, you know, it's just something to think about when I'm set that's sort of like a challenge to me. And then I look at my set and go like, okay, if I want to achieve that shot, I can't get a techno crane. But we can get a jib. And if we ran the jib this way, we could get sort of like a mini move of that. And it would look good. And sort of like those types of things. And in my day, it's going to cost me this. So it's always sort of like that balance. And then when I'm even writing, there's sort of a, hey, this happens in the scene and blah, 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 blah. And then I think about it. I go, okay, that's a stunt coordinator. That's a this, that's a that, that's a this. Okay, maybe I don't have enough money to shoot a scene like this. I have to rethink about this. Maybe it's not a car chase. Maybe it's a foot chase. So I can still tell the same sort of narrative story that there's a chase, there's somebody being pursued, there's something happening, but there's a level of it. If there's cars, it's more expensive. If it's on foot, it's a lot cheaper. And it can still be just as exciting. It can still be shot in an exciting way. You just need to be able to, you know, produce what's on your page. And so it helps me as a writer, it helps me as a director, it helps me as a producer to know all of these things. So working on set, you know, I've got to work on, you know, The Rookie for ABC. I was on that for 2 seasons. I was on Why Women Kill, American Horror Stories. I worked for a season of Chad that never got released to TV, season 2. I hope it gets released one day because it was a fun year. I've done piecemeal like commercials. I worked on Finest Kind coming out for Paramount Plus next year as you know, on the AD team. And it's, you know, I basically look for any type of production where I can do it. And by working these productions, they're not full time. It's not like it's a 52 week a year guaranteed job. You literally at most can maybe get like a 6 month guarantee or a 5 month guarantee because that's the run of show. But in between, I can sort of say like, hey, I'm not going to work full time on the show. I'm going to work as a freelance additional PA. So I'm only going to be on 3 days a week. And that gives me more time to work on Never Hike Alone. Or I'm not going to work for anybody right now because I need to take 2 weeks off to go shoot Never Hike Alone. And so it has allowed me sort of the freedom. I've had to give up a lot in my life as far as like the types of things that I could afford and, you know, the lifestyle and all of that of being higher up in the food chain and the management department. But being on the low rung gives me the freedom that I need, almost like a young 20 something who's just starting out their career, you know, the freedom and creativity that they have, that they need in order to generate material to build their own brand. And so it's been a balance of both of those things. And I feel like with the release of Never Hike Alone 2, it's coming to a very nice balance because now I don't have the burden of shooting Never Hike Alone anymore. And I don't have anything on my slate that's more than a 2 to 3 day shoot if I was going to crowdfund it. And if I do another feature film, it will be original. And at that point, I would be getting paid to be on set. So now it sort of makes sense for me to shift into another, you know, part of my career where I could spend more time being at a full-time position, whether that's working in post-production or whether that's, you know, working on another set or working in development or, you know, whatever then that ends up becoming. I feel more comfortable about getting back into that type of role because now Never Hike Alone 2 is an entire journey. It's been, you know, if you count the first Never Hike Alone, it's been about a 6-7 year journey just for this part of it. Coming to the end of it, now I feel like I'm going back into my career as a full-time employee with a lot more experience because I ran my own company and the ability to generate my own content whenever I feel like, okay, I have a good idea. I can take this to crowdfunding. You know, I'm not going to need 2 weeks to shoot it. I'm going to need a weekend to shoot it, or I'm going to need 2 weekends to shoot it. And asking for a couple Fridays off from a job is a lot easier than asking for 3 months off. So now I can actually say like, yes, I will be here and do that. But I don't think people really realize how much I've had to sacrifice in order to bring Womp Stomp to where it is right now.
Wow. Long open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
So with Never Hike Alone 2, is that going to be the last film in the series that you're doing? Or are you going to make like Never Hike Alone 3? Or is it just going to be a 2-part thing, 3-part thing? What do you want to do with that?
No, this will be the last live action Friday the 13th project that we will film. This is the end of the story. Originally, we're supposed to do technically we're supposed to do quote unquote three more, but this is actually those three stories in one film because the original idea was to do a series where they'd all be 25 minutes long, and you know, we could do them episodically over the course of 2 years and like really kind of like break our productions up to make things a little bit easier on everybody. But after the pandemic and already having to wait 2 years and our fan base grew, we were like, well, why don't we see if we can shoot the whole thing right now? Like, let's just shoot two through four and call it one thing because it's just one movie. And in fact, Never Hike Alone 2 started as this script and sort of. It started as a script that was basically a lot of the same beats. I ended up adding Never Hike in the Snow and splitting it up into four pieces. And then I ended up just putting the three pieces that I originally split up back together with sort of changes that had come up over the years and also looking at budgetary wise, like, okay, I always wanted to do this. I always wanted to set fire to this thing, but we don't really have the money to set fire. And plus there's like fire bans and where we're shooting. So probably not a good idea. Let me change the idea of this scene, things like that. But that will be the end, but this will be the end of Never Hike Alone as far as like this storyline, the Kyle MacLeod, Tommy Jarvis, Diana Hill, Rick Colon, Jason Voorhees storyline of this kind of this setting. This is the last story of that. We still have Ghosts in the Fog, which is an animated short film that we're developing with a company called Mako Animation, based out of Guadalajara, Mexico. They're a very good animation company. They do a lot of work down there. They took a very big interest in what we were doing. They're big fans. They're supporters of Never Hike Alone. So we became friends with Juan, the owner. And we've been working with them over the last year to sort of develop this proof of concept short film. It's about 8 minutes long. We want to get that done over the course of the next year and release that. And then I have two other stories. One of them's like basically a Pamela's tale. And then the other one is called The Ghost of Crystal Lake, which is the origin of Ghost Jason. And if I was to ever film or make any of those, they would be through the animation pipeline that we're developing with Mako versus having to go out to live action. So again, if it's animation, I can be anywhere in the world. I can talk to my storyboard artists, I can talk to my editors, I can talk to my animation team. I can be at a full-time job and I can get home and answer my emails at the end of the day, or I can answer them at lunch or take meetings. It takes a lot off my shoulders and it allows me to expand the story, but these stories are stories of the past and not the future. You know, Ghost of Crystal Lake takes place around like literally at the end, it picks up right at the end of Jason Takes Manhattan. A Pamela story takes place starting in 19, basically starting in 1957 when he drowned. Picking up a few weeks after he's you know, he drowned and died, and you know, has also gone missing, you know what I mean? So they're cool, two cool stories, and Ghost in the Fog takes place somewhere between Disappear and Never Hike in the Snow, so somewhere between 2004 and 2017. You know, Ghost in the Fog could be any time in between there in this sort of like region of time in which we've sort of explained that Jason has gone, he's turned into a ghost. No one can find him anymore. And if anyone does run into, you know, run into Jason at Camp Crystal Lake during the periods between 2004 and 2017, there's a good chance they're not making it out. Or actually, there's a 1,000% chance they're not making it out because the only person to ever escape in this time period is Kyle MacLeod. We watched Mark Hill almost escape. But he was the last person to go missing before Kyle MacLeod, and that's why we told his story because his disappearance leads into storylines about his mother and Tommy and Rick and all of these things that are tied together in Never Hike Alone 2. So these other stories are really offshoot things that have nothing really to do with Never Hike Alone 2, other than seeing how and why we have Ghost Jason operate the way that he does and put a little bit, give fans a little bit more answers as to how this series sort of would have continued after part eight if they didn't go the Jason takes Manhattan, I mean Jason goes to hell route, if they kept it sort of in that Paramount logic, and you know, Jason would have had to get back to Camp Crystal Lake. So there's a story about him going back. You know, and then with Pamela's story, really sort of like how this whole thing got started, how the curse got started. And you know, give fans kind of like a nice, I think if you look at all of these projects and all of these stories all together, You just get a nice sort of overview of Friday the 13th, a nice summary of Friday the 13th that I think the films never really sort of expressed. They just gave us fun films. They gave us fun kills. They gave us fun characters, but they never delved into sort of like the mythos or, you know, the origins, or really kind of brought those things up. And when they did delve into those things, like in Jason Goes to Hell, they sort of presented things to fans that were not quite right. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. To me, like, Friday the 13th has nothing to do with the Necronomicon. Pamela Voorhees wasn't a witch. She's not reading from ancient texts and reading Latin, trying to bring her son back. That just doesn't feel like something that's in the realm of a, you know, a cook at a camp, who's been running around as a single mother her entire life. It just seems to change the characters in a way that wasn't, you know, great. And aside from that, like, no one's ever really kind of delved into it. And then a lot of the things you really like read, like, you know, I read a Pamela's Tale, the comic book, and what did it do? It sort of did the Rob Zombie thing where, you know, Elias was an abusive drunk who beat Pamela, and so she killed him. And it's just the same story we heard over and over again. But if you go back and you read some of the history on Friday the 13th, like, I think it's like, it's a book called, you know, Tales from Blairstown, or it came from Blairstown or something like that. And there's an interview with Betsy Palmer in it, who talks about Pamela and saying that she came up with a backstory for her. She didn't come from abusive drunk. She didn't come from all of these just things. She, you know, she fell in love as a teenager. She had sex. She got pregnant. You know, the father denied it. The parents kicked her out, and she started living a life on the road with her son. And all she had was her son in her life, and moving on and moving on and moving on. So I feel like that's the place to come from with her story. And not necessarily make it about the typical things that we see about abusive drunks and all of these different things, but how hard it is to fit in as a single mother in the real world in 1950s with a deformed child and child out of wedlock. And kind of focus on that story, but how she went mad and how, you know, all of these different things that kind of like came into how Jason was able to come back from death, and how he returned from the lake, and how he was always there the whole time and no one could just ever find him, which is kind of, you know, it's kind of a sad tale in itself if you really think about it. But yeah, there's lots of things I want to explore there, but it's going to become more of a hobby, sort of spending some free time there. A lot of my energy is going to go into original productions, original shorts. Everything that's live action is going to be original. Anything that's fan film is going to move to animated. And we'll run crowdfunds for those and we'll do those, but I really can't, you know, take time off and, you know, invest any more of like my working time to fan films, because eventually I need to start making money again and getting my life back together.
No, I hear that. That's a lot. I mean, yeah. I like is and like what you're doing. I mean, it's a lot of, like, I feel like a lot of filmmakers, like, when they create Friday the 13th, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, they just use the same elements and do the same thing over and over again, which doesn't make it original or scary or even good, in my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think with anybody's interpretation of a fan film or anything, it's really up to them, because, like, sometimes, like, I've been in fan films where it was literally just meant to be an homage. You know what I mean? Like, we're going to copy it shot for shot. We're going to show that we can, you know, do that shot for shot. And sometimes I tell people, like, if you haven't filmed before, if you haven't done it before, the best way to learn is to look at a scene from a film and recreate it, because then you start to learn the pieces of what it took to create each shot, where you had to set up the lights, how you had to set up the angles, the lens that you had to choose. Like, if you shoot it and it doesn't look the same, well, you got to figure out what's off. You know what I mean? It's sort of like a puzzle game. And I think the biggest thing with fan films, it's like the attitude you take into it of what you're trying to do with it. At the end of the day, are you making this fan film because you and your friends felt inspired and you wanted to go out and you wanted to have fun and you wanted to come up with some ideas? Maybe you got a friend who's like a really good VFX artist and you're like, you're the star of the show, man. Like, you do it. You like come up with some cool gags and we're going to film it. You know what I mean? Like, you figure out sort of like what your shtick is and then you go. If you go into fan films thinking like, well, this is a whole industry now and I can, you know, I can make this fan film and I can become famous and then I can charge for my autograph. Well, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. Like, I've been doing fan films for now 6-7 years. I have never once charged for an autograph for anything related to Never Hike Alone or any other fan film I've ever done. The only time I've ever done anything at a convention is for stuff that I was in that was actually original production. And somebody wants something from a 13 fanboy, or, you know, if not that it's ever happened, but if anyone, I probably wouldn't even charge for like a free bird or anything like that, like type of signature, or even some of the stuff I've worked on. But in the future, when I start making, you know, original productions and things like that, and if I get asked to be at a convention, yeah, I'll ask for some money then. But I find that I think the fan film world is filled with too many people that think a fan film is going to make them famous, or that's like their goal out of it, is to become popular on social media. And honestly, like, I don't care about being popular on social media. I don't need followers. I don't want any of that stuff. I just want people to watch what I'm doing, and then I'm fine to just be my nerdy lame self. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need people following me around and doing that stuff. I just want Friday the 13th fans to be happy, and I want to go out with my friends and be challenged and have the challenge of making films. Like, the social media side of it is it's almost like a burden to me, because I'd rather be spending time on the creative than, you know, coming up with a post for Facebook, or coming up with a, you know, a reel for Instagram or something for TikTok, where I don't know. I didn't do all of this. I don't have 16 years in production and all of these things to think about what I want to do for a 30-second vertical video. I mean, that is like the last thing I want to do is a vertical video of any kind. So it's like, for me, it's like, ugh, I feel like I'm taking a step back in the world of cinema to like, okay, now I have to like adhere to the rules of now, and I have to make this like video that has no value to me, but it will at least get the word out about the film, I guess. And I just, it's too hard for me not to want to put effort into something, even that small, but that's not sort of what gets rewarded these days. Like, the most simplest thing of like doing a 15 second video of you like shaking your ass for 2 seconds will get 10 million views. But I'll invest, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars into a thing and post it and make a nice, like, you know, trailer for it on TikTok, and it will get like a couple hundred likes. And it's like, where is the appreciation gone in this world for things that actually have quality versus just like kind of nonsense sort of posting that I see on social media all the time? But, you know, that's just me. And I hope one day I can just focus on film and not have to worry about social media, and whoever the distributor is can worry about that stuff. But because I have to bite the bullet, and I have to do something I don't love, and I need to find things that I like about it. But I will say that, like, as much as I don't like the work of social media, I do like connecting with fans. I do like bumping into people in you know, at a convention or in public, and just not so much, you know, celebrating Never Hike Alone or anything like that. It's more about just kind of finding someone who wants to nerd out about Friday the 13th. If you're talking to me about this movie, then we have similar interests, and let's talk about the interest versus like, you know, having to, you know, wax my moon. Like, I'm fine. Like, I'm happy with what I've made. I'm glad people like it. But for me, like, I'm in it because I want to see Friday the 13th get better. I want to see these TV shows that are coming out match the, you know, the hype that they're going to be put on them. I want new films as they come out to sort of take as much care and appreciation as we did with, you know, 30 times more of our budget. That'd be nice. You know what I mean? Like, I just want people to care about Friday the 13th as much as I do is really sort of the end goal for me.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, no, so I heard that they're doing a show. What's the show called? Like, they're doing a show about it. What's the show called?
Yeah, the show is going to be on Peacock. It's called Crystal Lake. It is being show run by the same guy who did Hannibal. His name is Brian Fuller. He's a very, and I think he's doing a remake of Christine too. And he just got back from, I think, Budapest, where he was shooting a film with Mads Mikkelsen, reunited with him from Hannibal, called Dust Bunny. So, and Brian's been around for a long time. I think he worked in Star Trek earlier on in his career, if I remember correctly, Star Trek Discovery. But he's been a showrunner for a long time. He's very prolific. You know, he's stylized. I think Hannibal is one of the most stylized, cool shows that I've seen in a very long time. Crystal Lake is going to be set in 1950s. It's going to be all about Pamela. It's going to be set in like 1956, 57, I guess. I'm not sure exactly where it's going to start. They never really went into details, but apparently the film does jump around in time too. So we're going to see Pamela. We're going to see Jason as an adult. And Brian even said if they go 10 seasons, they're doing a Jason X season. So from what I see, Brian is a real fan. He, you know, it's it, he doesn't, you know, I, over the years, I've watched people make Friday the 13th films. And when they get asked questions about the franchise, it usually sort of gives away that they're not really big fans. Like, they know of it and they probably saw it a couple times. They thought it was pretty cool, but they're not psychos about it like the rest of us. Brian is a psycho like the rest of us. You know, Friday the 13th really affected him as a kid. You know, he grew up with the franchise. He's been a lover of the franchise for a long time. Everything that I've heard from people that are sort of like in or around it or who know him personally, like, he's legitimate. He's got the right idea in mind as far as like having the passion behind being a Friday the 13th fan first and then generating material for other Friday the 13th fans to enjoy. So I'm really looking forward to that. Like I said, it's going to be on Peacock. Right now it's being delayed by the writers and SAG strike. So, you know, we're probably not going to see anything on that until 2024. And then as far as the films go, I just got word from sort of like the people that I have out in the world of, you know, who know what. You know, I got one person telling me that there's some pretty good news going on behind the scenes for a film. And so I said, okay, I'll wait for that news to drop. And then I had someone else reach out to me yesterday who got sort of like very close to like some really good sources who are like, no, the rights are still so screwed up with the film. They're nowhere close to it. So it's, you know, I think with the feature film stuff, it's still kind of a wash. But again, like, I hope they find a director who's like Brian, who has that when they say, like, it's not, you know, oh, you know what, I made another monster movie, so I guess I'll come make another one. Like, I think with Marcus Nispel, as nice of a guy that he is, I think that what it was they had someone else in mind. They dropped. Marcus had done such a good job with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. They said, come back and do Friday the 13th. He was like, what do you mean come back and do Friday the 13th? I don't want to do Friday the 13th. I want to do original productions. And he sort of got forced into it. And there were things about the movie that were just sort of off and things that he didn't catch as a fan that fell through to me as a fan watching it being like, well, why did they do this? Or why did they do that? You know, same thing with Ronnie Yu. I don't think Ronnie Yu was a huge fan of either Jason or Freddy, but he had done Bride of Chucky and had done a big thing for New Line, so like, oh, give it to Ronnie, you know what I mean? It wasn't like any of these people like were almost like a Kane Hodder coming into the role of Jason, where it's like that's where you see really people sort of, you know, I think in my opinion excel in Friday the 13th, is when they're given an opportunity in Friday the 13th and they're already a fan of it. You know, obviously there has to be a franchise for it to be there, but Kane Hodder was good Jason because he was a fan of Jason before he took the role. And he wanted to bring something to it, and he brought something to it that connected with fans. And I think that, you know, even John Carl Beekler and Tom McLaughlin, you know, Joe Zito, Steve Miner, I think that they all recognize things that the fans really wanted to see, or even them as themselves as storytellers really recognize that. And they brought a lot of it because they had the passion for it. And when somebody doesn't have the passion for it, I think you see it fall through, or there's a big disconnect with fans. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think I'm really excited about the TV show. I'm really worried about the movies because I'm not sure, like, that person isn't in there yet. There's no one associated with the film right now that I could say that person is a Friday the 13th hero. When they talk about it, I can tell they love it. And I'm glad that they're in charge. And I think that that's what fans need right now. And they need somebody who's like excited and somebody who has a good idea and somebody who not only has an idea for a movie, but has an idea for a franchise. Has an idea for a trilogy now. You know what I mean? Like, don't write it as you go like they did in the past. Like, think about what you need for three films, set things up, and give fans a real treat. Because there's a reason why Friday the 13th is a franchise. Like, maybe Friday the 13th never made the best movie. They never made something like a Halloween or a Texas Chainsaw Massacre as a singular film on that level. I would argue that Jason, either Jason Lives does, or even Friday the 13th Part 2 does. But as a franchise as a whole, no one else compares to Friday the 13th. And I feel like that's Friday the 13th's bread and butter. It's not coming up with one great film, but coming up with a longer told story over three different films that can probably all be between $15 and $20 million, if not less. And fans will show up. And fans will want, and they'll be chomping at the bit for the next movie. You know what I mean? If they do it right. And I think that's what fans want. We want to go to the theater. We want to eat up the films and we want to be chomping at the bit for the next one. And that's what it reminds me as a kid when I was coming up and my first film was, you know, Jason Lives, and going back through and chomping at the bit to watch all the other ones and then wait for the new ones to come out. But it feels like ever since then, there's just been a lot of disappointment. It's waiting, waiting, waiting. And a film comes out and you're disappointed. So with Never Hike Alone, for me, it was like, I'm going to stop waiting for the films to give me what I want, and I'm just going to create what I want for myself, which sort of ruins it for myself, because it's not like I can sit down and watch Never Hike Alone as a, you know, a neutral party. You know, I know everything that's kind of going on. I built the ride, so I know where all the scares are coming, and I'm just making sure it's running technically as it's supposed to run, versus being able to sit down and enjoy it as a fan. So when I see other fans enjoying it the way that I used to enjoy Friday the 13th, I think that's where I get my satisfaction out of it, and I want someone else to have that same satisfaction in the director's seat of a feature film as well.
Hey, that's awesome. I like that. What's your favorite film, Friday the 13th film of all time? What's the least favorite that you like?
Jason Lives is definitely the top. Believe it or not, my least favorite Friday the 13th film is the remake.
Okay.
Because it let me down the most. I think my expectation of the remake outgrew what it actually delivered. I think, yeah, if you look at it on paper, it delivered exactly what a Friday the 13th was. But if you've seen anything that I've done with Never Hike Alone, you realize that, like, I've been waiting for something a little bit more. And maybe that was asking a little bit too much. But I feel like when you look at the resources that they had and the choices that they made versus even some of, like, the more inferior production ones of the films, like Friday the 13th Part 5, where, you know, Jason Goes to Hell to a certain degree, Jason X, like, this film had $19 million and could have done anything. And they chose tunnels. They chose to shoot Texas. They chose to not, like, fix any of the continuity issues or do anything. They just kind of, like, it was like stamp and repeat the old formula and don't veer from it. And, you know, the characters weren't great. I thought that, like, for the money that they had and what they were doing, that it just sort of, like, I don't know. I just felt it was I didn't feel like I was getting the experience that I wanted out of it. And it was the one that I thought, like, and also the marketing campaign leading up to it, them talking about, like, oh, this is a Rambo Jason. This is a smart Jason. This is a Jason that does this and does that. And then I got into the theater and I went, Jason didn't do that at all. Like, Jason's actually a big fucking moron in this movie. Like, he does the dumbest shit. Like, why did you make Jason so damn dumb? Like, he could have been smart. You could have had him do smart things all over the place here, but you chose to do the dumbest shit the entire time just for a fun scene, but a fun scene that doesn't connect into the overall theory of what you were pitching before. So technically, I'm not getting what you pitched. Whereas, like, when I walked into Jason X, I wasn't expecting anything. I wasn't expecting anything good. And I walked out with, like, a fun time because I had a fun time with my friends. And I would say that, like, Jason Goes to Hell would be next on that list as far as, like, letdown wise, because they blow up Jason in the first 5 minutes and then have him as a body hopping demon snake. But this was 1993. Things were crazy. And there are things about that film that you can kind of, like, if you break it off and just watch it on its own, it at least works in its own, within its own narrative. I just wouldn't necessarily call it a Friday the 13th film. And then, I don't know. I feel like Freddy versus Jason is okay. I'm not a big fan of the way Jason was portrayed in the film. And then the rest of the films, all the way from Jason X through 1, I would say I like that. I love Jason Lives. That's my favorite one. And then it's like, then it's Part 4 and then it's Part 2. And then after that, like, all of the other films just kind of float in a thing like, yeah, if it's on, I'll watch it. People hate on Part 8. I love Part 8. I watched that one a lot when I was a kid. I think that it's one of Kane's best performances. I think that at least it's carrying on from the previous film. It's, you know, in certain ways, and then other ways it goes off the rails, but I don't really worry about that too much because it still feels like a Paramount Friday. Same thing with Part 7. I'm not a huge fan of Part 7, not a big fan of the telekinesis or doing the shtick, but at least Jason's cool in that film. It's one of the best looks and things like that. There's like redeeming qualities about it, but I feel like, and those are all, like, you know, low tier, low value productions that were done by Paramount in the 80s and, you know, all throughout the 80s. When you're talking about a film that was made in 2009 with $20 million and you can do everything, it's like, it's tough for me to find a redeeming quality. I don't like the look of Jason. I don't like how some of the kills were filmed. I don't like any of the characters. Like, there's not one character that when they come on screen, I'm like, oh, good, they're here to save the movie. Everybody, literally, every time they cut to somebody else, I'm like, oh my God, not them. Like, it's just, you know, I do think that Derek Mears gives a good performance as Jason, just in a bad costume. And so I feel like Jason has had costume issues ever since, you know, 93. I feel like this the franchise has had story issues ever since part 7. And, you know, it's been since 1986 since someone's done something that's actually like felt like, wow, this is as good as it gets. And so Jason Lives is really like the high watermark for me of the Friday the 13th franchise, with, you know, I would say Final Chapter and part 2 being right there, and part 3 is not far behind, and part 1's not far behind. But, you know, it's been since that long since we've had something that really, I think, has sent fans home like in unison, being really excited about the franchise and, you know, and its future. So I hope that's what it has in store for its future.
Yeah, no, I feel the same. I mean, they did the same thing with A Nightmare on Elm Street remake. That remake was horrible. I thought that one was the worst one.
I will say the Nightmare on Elm Street remake is a lot worse than the 2009. Like, Friday the 13th, I would say, has a couple of redeeming qualities with a couple of the kills. Like, the axe kill is great. I love the axe kill. There's a couple things in there that are kind of redeeming, but yeah, they really messed up that Nightmare one, though.
Yeah, I don't think they're never going to come back from that. Did you watch the new Halloween Ends?
I did. I watched all three new Halloween movies. I got a nice entry. I got a nice, I actually got to see the first Halloween a little early, which was pretty cool. I got invited to a special screening, and saw it there. I think with the new Halloween trilogy, I think there's a lot of great things about them. And I think the saddest thing about them is that all three films are really good. They just mess up one, each one messes up one specific element that sort of like deflates the rest of it. Like, I feel like Halloween 1, the Sartain kind of tangent, ruins the momentum of the film. Right. It stops the movie, and all of a sudden we're stopping to do this. And then you get this, like, the dude puts on the mask, and at that point you're like, this is blasphemy. How dare he? And then sort of like, then the film stops and it kind of finds its way back. But it was like, that film was great, except for that one part. Same thing with Kills. It was sort of the same thing. It was like, everything was great. And then you started going on and on about Evil Dies Tonight, and I got sick of it. And the film could have been 20 minutes shorter if you just cut all that out and you just stuck with the main storyline. And you turn that, like, chasing the wrong person around town, who's obviously not Michael Myers. Like, people know what Michael Myers looks like. They have a photo of him that they can share into the world. Like, how do you mistake, you know, Oscar Cobblepot from Tim Burton's Batman Returns with 6'4" Michael Myers? Like, it was just a very silly, forced thing. And so I thought that was kind of crazy. But you remove that, you get this amazing introduction, that which is what I wanted out of the first movie, actually, which was like, explain to me how Michael got caught. You know, show me that. And so to see the 78 flashback, that was really, really awesome. And obviously, like, the gore and the violence and kills is great. And I feel like the Corey Cunningham and End story could have worked. They messed up the baton exchange, where this moment where we're supposed to see sort of this evil pass on to this next person, this other person to be inspired to be evil or to be taken over by Michael's spirit or whatever they were trying to say, they chose a very lame way to do it. I thought the locking eyes in a moment where, like, he's grabbing Corey and Corey's trying to get away, there's a lot of things that didn't make sense about that. It happened so quick, you can miss it. Versus something that was a little bit more concrete, where if they wanted to go that route and they wanted to take a very, you know, what's the word? They wanted to do a very, like, bold move and kill Michael, sort of like eliminate him from the equation and not make him the killer of part 3, so it plays into Halloween 3 and do all of those things. I would have had him crawl into that sewer at the end of Halloween Kills and just die, but no one can find his body type thing. And Corey ends up running from these kids, finding the body, finding the mask, finding the things, and realizes that he's the one who found the body and he could report it. But these people have pissed him off so much. And then just sitting there staring at Michael's mask, staring into the emptiness that's behind the eyes, something changes in him. And you see that he decides to take on the mantle of Michael and hides it as a secret type thing. And I think at that point you have something that's a little bit more of a dramatic turn versus this very confusing, like, why is Michael letting him live? Why would Michael think that he could ever trust this kid? I mean, this kid knows where he lives now. Why isn't this kid running to the police and saying, hey, I could be a hero and I could show you where Michael is and everyone would love me. But no, I'm going to be weird. And I'm gonna start to snap. And it just didn't make a lot of sense. And I know that, like, that old man got killed or whatever because he did that. But at the same time, he could always blame Michael.
Yeah.
Like, I, you know what I mean? I just think it was one of those things where, like, sometimes you can try to do too much, and you could try to subvert fan expectation to the degree in which it sort of backs you into a corner of making a film that the fans just don't want to see at all. And I feel like, you know, I pitched a good version of the Corey Cunningham film, but what did fans really want? They wanted Michael versus Lori. And when you do that for that long and you build it up for that, those many years, and you sideline Lori for the second film, and then you bring her back for the last one and you change her character and she's totally off base with who she was before at a time when there's actually a threat of Michael still being out there versus the first time when he was actually in a penitentiary. When he was in a penitentiary, she was in a penitentiary. And now that he's out in the open, she's put herself out in the open after her daughters got killed. I don't get it at all. There's a lot of weird logic issues here with sort of the way that it's constructed. And listen, like, I'm sure that David Gordon Green could come on and re-explain this in a way that makes a lot more sense than I read it. But as a fan, I can understand why people are upset. And these are the reasons why people are upset. You know, when you do all that and all of a sudden the fight between Lori and Michael happens in a kitchen and takes 2 seconds. That's fans wanted more. But at the same time, you have, again, like, kind of what I was talking about before. You have Jamie Lee Curtis, who is, what, in her 70s now?
Yeah, about 70, yeah.
Yeah, what are you going to have her do? The big fight scenes and kind of toss her around all movie? You'll break her. You can't, you know, can't break a screen queen like that. You got to be kind to her. And plus, they were trying to tell this story. I just think that, you know, I think that they should have just given fans what they wanted. Come up with something that fit that narrative that, like, you know, Michael... If anything, it would have been cool. Like, and this is what I thought was going to happen. I thought that, and it's not to say that, like, I think this is cool because I thought of it, but I thought that this was a good idea that Michael really did disappear and go away and find some place, but somebody wanted to do some shit in Haddonfield. So they took up the mantle of Michael and they started killing people. And that's what drew Michael back, type of thing. So there's like a Scooby-Doo element for the fact that somebody in town is basically screaming, you know, becoming a ghost face, killing people in town. Everybody thinks it's Michael, but Lori's like, no, this is not Michael. It's not his MO. This isn't what he does. This isn't how he does it. And then in the process of discovering who it actually is, this thing actually draws Michael out and the real monster shows up at the end of the movie. And all of a sudden now they got to deal with the real Michael and the imposter is killed. And then you deal with the real thing. And there's sort of a growth of that in there, but the Corey Cunningham and the way it all works, it's just so messy and so odd that it just, I think it pulled people out. I think if it was a mystery of who the killer was and you played the whole story, like, it became Corey's movie, but if it was played from the perspective of Lori and it was played from the perspective of, you know, her daughter or her granddaughter, then they're the main stars of the film again. That's who we came to see. And then you sort of look at your cast of characters and you almost have a giallo in a way where you're like, who is it? Like, who are these people? Why are these people getting killed? And then at the end of the movie, you get the reveal of being like, oh my God, it was Corey the whole time. He was right there the whole time. And of course you're going to suspect the boyfriend, but if he's sweet and innocent enough and he's the one getting picked on all the time and he's the last person you think would be killing people, you get the Kaiser Soze of it all. And then you have Michael show up and now everybody's in trouble. And there's a nice growth to that story versus what they did where they really tried hard to make Corey an unlikable character. Like, right. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sorry, but you got beat up by band geeks. Like, and now you can DDT like Michael Myers all of a sudden, like three scenes later or like, you know, half a movie later. Like, you can't have both. You can't get beat up by the band geeks and then, you know, Stone Cold Stunner, you know, Michael Myers and then take his mask. Like, you're not the same person. Like, this isn't like, I don't get it. There's lots of stuff like that, but I mean, that's what it is. And that's the risk that you take. And that's the risk that they took as filmmakers. And me, I sort of, I know what I want as a fan. And my hope and want with Friday the 13th isn't to subvert expectations. I know I don't do the formula, but I play it really close to the line as far as like who Jason is and what Jason will do, and really make sure that the logic is lined up about like everything that happens. But it more and more becomes Friday the 13th, the more of a bigger budget we get, because we can actually afford those things. The only reason why I didn't do the formula with my first film is because I didn't have money to make a good looking, you know, slasher film that had a body count. So that's another strategy too. It's like, if I only have the money for one kill, well, I'm only going to write one kill into the movie. I'm not going to write eight bad kills. I'm going to do one good one. And that one's going to stand it, and I'm going to write everything around it. And so, you know, I just think that that's sort of strategically how I work. But yeah, the Halloween films sort of, like I said, like they're fine, but it feels like there were too many cooks in the kitchen, too many writers, too many ideas. And if they had just streamlined their idea and made it simple, fans would have chewed it up. It would have been a lot easier to swallow, and they may have even had even more success.
Gotcha. So I'm going to have to go, but is there anything you want to plug? I know Never Hike Alone comes out October 12th or 15th. When's it come out again?
Comes out on Friday the 13th, baby.
Friday the 13th. All right.
Yep, the 6-year anniversary to the first Never Hike Alone, October 13th, Friday the 13th. It's going to debut at night. I don't have the time just yet because we're in conjunction with a festival who's going to premiere it. And in the meantime, the Indiegogo is still open. So the credits are going to close on September 25th. So that's the last day you're going to be able to get an IMDb credit for sure. We're going to leave it open for a few more days because I'm going to slowly add names as I can. But 25th is like the absolute drop dead day that I can guarantee that I'll be able to get in and fix the credits. The campaign's going to remain open. We're also running a raffle right now to become an executive producer. It's called the Jarvis versus Jason raffle. The winner of this raffle will be selected as our final executive producer on the film. Their name will be listed under Tom Matthews as an executive producer. They will get all the perks from the campaign, and then they will also receive the screen used working Tommy shotgun. So it's like it pumps, it does everything. It's like a real replica. It doesn't shoot real bullets, but it's a real replica. It's really, really cool, and it's screen used. So this is the one that Tom Matthews used to actually fight Jason on screen. You have to either get the Blu-ray, the 8x10s, the poster, some VHS, or the Jarvis versus Jason bundle. That raffle will close on the 25th. I will collect everyone's names, go through that, organize it. The winner will be selected on September 30th. I'm weighing whether or not the winner will be announced that day, or if we'll announce them when they watch the film and they have to tune in and watch it. Might be a cool way to do it, but you definitely want a chance to do this. But you also walk away with a lot of really cool merch. Credits start at $10. We have also producer credits that start at $2,500. And we have one last associate producer credit, and then we have co-producer, producer, and executive producer levels that all come with cool things. And if you become a producer, no matter what, not through the raffle, but through a producer just paying in, you will walk away with a piece of the movie. You'll have your selection of a series of props that we'll list after the film and all the spoilers are out for you to choose from and take home.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thanks. Thank you again for coming on.
Thanks for having me, TJ. I really appreciate it.
Likewise. And yeah, this will be up some point tomorrow, but I'll tag you in and all that once it hits.
Yeah, beautiful. Tagging with me is the best day, because then I just share it right to my story and everything works from there.
Awesome. Sounds good. Well, thanks again.
All right. Thank you, TJ.
Yep. See ya. Bye.
All right, guys. That's going to wrap up today's show. Hope you guys enjoyed it. If you did, like, subscribe on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Anchor.fm. I will post a video on producer TJ995 on TikTok. And so on and so forth. All right. Love you all to death. See you guys later. And like I said, I'll give you 3 episodes next week. And, you know, a couple interviews as well. I may have somebody famous coming on next week, too. Stay tuned for that. All right, guys. Love you. Peace out. And bye.